Alrighty. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Art Drama Llama, where we look beyond the galleries and dish on the art world's gossip, rivalries, and eccentricities. My name is Sianja.
My name is Banshee.
And I'm Bartika.
And today we're going to look beyond
Artists who's been erased from art history.
So a lot of artists. No, I'm kidding.
A lot of artists. But this specific one today we're going to talk about. Her name is Charlotte Pozanensky. And I wanted to talk about her because the reason she was sort of dropped from the art world was because she decided to stop creating art entirely and then also died early. So, you know, that doesn't always help.
I'm kidding.
Oh, I'm going to get so much.
What's her zodiac? Because that's very typical of that zodiac. I bet she's an Aquarius. Okay, I'm done. I have no beef with Aquariuses. Zodiac community, don't come for me.
They're going to come for you, Sandra.
You know what? We are a drama podcast.
If we don't have any controversy around us, are we even doing what we're supposed to be doing?
As we've learned from our prominent media people.
Yeah.
Any attention is good attention.
Exactly. So no such thing as bad press.
Wait, we have a marketing student here. Agree or disagree?
I mean, it depends on the scenario, but in our case, yeah, any media, any press would be good press.
Okay. I was waiting for you to be like, I didn't study that kind of marketing.
That's
I mean, we do need / want the attention. I don't know how many listeners we still have after our hiatus. So...
Well, to be fair, my friend was like, oh, you guys are uploading episodes again? I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, my aunt also was like, I've noticed y'all are updating.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got a few fans from work.
Oh, yay. Awesome.
Yes.
Work friends.
Yes, yes, yes. Shout out to Dante if you're listening to this episode. He said we were very professional sounding. He loved our Banksy episodes from 2 years ago.
Pretty good. Well, hello, Dante. Dante is such a great name. Just like Charlotte Charlotte Pozanensky.
Yes, back to her. Yes. Let's not erase her from this conversation.
Exactly. We can't have Dante overshadowing. So Charlotte was born in 1930 to a Jewish family. And I want to talk about her background a little bit because I think it does sort of, lead to her art. So Jewish family in 1930. Not a great time to be Jewish. So during the war, her friends hid her from the Nazis. And then when she was 9, her dad actually committed suicide to avoid persecution. But
a pretty rough childhood.
Yeah. After all that darkness, she did the only sane thing, which was to go study art. So after the war, she studied art under Willy Baumeister, who taught her about modernism, which the Nazis had attempted to obliterate when they were in power. And she particularly became interested in painters who had explored spatial qualities of pictorial surfaces, such as Cezanne and early Mondrian work. And she would travel to where they lived and made a lot of plein air paintings.
It sounds like she would have liked Georgia O'Keeffe.
I think so. I agree. She also worked in theater as a costume designer and also a stage designer. And these jobs actually influenced her future direction in a lot of ways. So theater exposed her to the idea that works of art can be collaboratively realized and also showed her how her works of art can be spatially transformative and set the conditions for creative thinking. So a lot of her later sculpture works were based on these fundamental ideas of space, how limitations can inform creativity, and then collaborative work, right? So all her sculptures later were meant to also invite and encourage creativity on part of the consumer. And her earliest works to date from the late 50s, her earliest surviving pictures date from the late 50s, and it shows that she was exploring contemporary movements such as informal and abstract expressionism. She also began to experiment with various abstract painting techniques like palette knife works or airbrushed pictures, and also played with a lot of formal strategies like partition grid, which is a tool for plotting three-dimensional space. She also turned to sculpture as a way to sort of invite total participation on behalf a total participation from the audience. And so
she sounds kind of like a jack of all trades.
Yeah, she like does a ton of different stuff, and I think she's very good at applying what she's learned from other, you know, mediums into her work. And she's like developing her art thesis through all her work experiences, which is really great to see and kind of track with the specific artist, right? I feel like we didn't do enough of that in the
Well, I also feel like that's really good of an artist to kind of like explore all mediums instead of like just sticking to one.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't know, I guess having like periods of you do one thing at one point in time and then another thing at another.
Yeah. And it's like, even if you do go through phases, like I think it's like, I'm thinking of Picasso, right? Who has distinctive phases in his life, but I think there's still stuff that transfers over from each phase. We just don't really talk about it, but like there has to be influences from his previous experiences and just the work that he's done that he's transferred over into new pieces. So it's not like completely from ground zero. Yeah. But I think she's very interesting, and also her desire to keep audiences engaged with her work. Like her entire motivation is to get people to participate and be in the spaces of her sculptures, which
she's very like about immersiveness.
Yeah, about the immersiveness, about the communication, like really trying to use art as a way to communicate ideas and thoughts with you and me, right? Which I guess every artist is, but I feel like they're not usually as explicit about it. Like a lot of times it's more like, I want to put this out there and then I want to see how people react. Whereas I think she's really trying to get people to like, there's like a hook, right? Like, and I don't think painters often think about, oh, I need a hook. It's just like, here's the message. So. Okay, so at the same time she was doing all her art, she was also super frustrated with politics. She was really frustrated with the centrist electoral political system at the time in Germany, and also the limited impact of groups like Social German Student Association, which she was an active member of. She saw her so Charlotte saw her sculptures as an alternative to art as usual and political organizing, and like really as a way to sort of reach out to people and talk about political ideas. But ultimately, though, she found art too open as a social tool. As Christine Meringue wrote in Art Form, making art more accessible, participatory, and interactive was, for Charlotte, not enough. It was not commensurate with her notions of political responsibility. So I think, you know, the whole point is that she was starting to feel frustrated with the fact that, like, even though she was putting out messages or maybe encouraging to think about things, it didn't actually lead to direct change. And you know, that was starting to become a bit frustrating for her as well. I don't know, I guess the question for you, Sianja, like, have you ever thought about politics in your work and art?
Yeah, I actually, like, since I, like, transferred to, like, the university I went to, I kept thinking, I was like, you know, I think being an artist is a little bit selfish because I just want to create. I just want to make these fun stories because I really wanted to be a storyboard artist. Yes.
Yeah.
And then I was all like, and at that time, a lot of like stuff was going on, like politically and like socially. And I was like, I don't like, yeah, you can say like, well, you're providing like positive outlooks or whatever with the stories you want to make, like, you know, you give people a break from what's going on. And I was like, I don't want to give people a break from what's going on. I don't want because I don't like escapism, you know. I truly believe that the media you consume is supposed to like inform you and teach you things versus like, I'm gonna escape my problems. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like whatever you're consuming, you know, for your mental stimulation should like subtly and unsubtly like help you grow as a person, you know? Like, yeah, like feed you good things. Mm-hmm. So I was all like, what can I do? What can I do? And I was like, sure, I could make stories about that, like tackle on hard subjects or whatever. Yeah, I could give the profits of that to like a charity or whatever of like that show, right? Like, let's say I make a show about like, I guess an example of like, or animation or whatever, of like the struggles of like being an immigrant in America, like based on like my specific in the city, or one of the biggest things that is talked about when it comes to like my ethnicity, which is like crossing the border and like the actual like trials and shit you have to go through for that. But I was like, that's not enough. I want to like be there. I want to like make something physical, because in the end, in animation, yeah, it's physical in the sense that you're making the frames, but the final product is a video. Like, a video is intangible,
right?
No, right. So I was like, I want to make something that's like there. And then from there, I really got into like printmaking, because if you look at printmaking, a lot of them is like political, and they very much take like social stances. Yeah. So I really liked that aspect of printmaking. And then I looked into like installation art. So I was like, oh, maybe I can make like a playground that's also like an artistic like end of art, you know?
That would be really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, maybe I can make like animation and installation art, and like depending on how you move things, you're making a mini animation. Like, you know, how can I incorporate animation every day? How can I make art part of everyday life? And then I got into UX design, which is like specifically because like there's two things with UX design. There's like kind of like the UI side of it, where it's like the interface, how to make a layout look pretty, the colors, all that. And there's kind of like the more like the production side of it, like product design, where you like make something that helps somebody that has Parkinson's hold like their fork and knife. And I really liked that side of it. So towards like the last 2 years of my degree, I really much, and even my capstone was a UX project.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like as an artist, it's very much downplayed the role designers have in the art world.
Yeah,
but very much so. You can't be an artist if you're not like a good designer, in my opinion.
Right.
So I don't know, I feel like in order to quantify all this and to relate back to the artist, I very much looked into design to kind of like feel that I was being an artist, but also I was contributing something to like my community at large.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, because design is so integral to making sure everyday functions well. It's like, that's why there's a podcast called 99% Invisible, like all about how design elements in our lives impacts the way we live subtly or not subtly. I agree. That's a good point. Yeah. Tiga, what do you think as a consumer of art? Do you feel do you feel moved by any political message that you see?
What do you mean?
Like, when I'm thinking of Guernica as an example, right? Which was a very deeply political art piece.
But yeah.
But do you feel moved to take action or be involved when you see something like that?
I mean, I guess there are some pieces of art or like things that I see that I'm like, oh yeah, I should do more for my community, or like I should go out and like volunteer more or whatever. But like, I don't know, it's hard to one, just like make time or like find the right opportunities. Cause like, yeah, you might want to go out and do things, but like the opportunities also have to be available. You can't just, I mean, yeah, you could create the opportunities, but that's a whole another I don't know, maybe I just overthink things to where I'm like, oh, this is going to be so much effort, or like, oh, this is also going to affect this and all that other stuff. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Because a lot of people, because I want to go into animation, right? They're like, why don't you just go to California? I'm like, you have just go to California money?
Mm.
I don't. And then they're like, well, why don't you like make something here? Blah, blah, blah. And I was all like, here's the thing, guys. I have responsibilities.
Yeah.
I can't just like, yes, yes. In theory, I can make an opportunity happen for me, for myself. It's okay. There are also animation studios here. I could, you know, in theory, be like, fuck all the animation industries. I'm going to make my own animation. And then there's like the theory of like, well, I'm going to make the best of what I have and like apply for animation studios here and like all that stuff. But then it's like circling back. It's like, if I make this opportunity for myself, what else am I sacrificing? Because, okay, I do it on my own. I will have no social life. I will neglect chores. I will, you know, like it'd be just coming home from work to work more, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, I apply for studios here and all that stuff. But a lot of them are like for commercials and things, which, you know, isn't bad. You're still animating, you're still doing. But like what I wanted to do was create cartoons. I'm a lot compared to like when I was like 20. I am more open to like making commercials and all that, just being able to practice, you know, what I went to school for. I would just be happy doing that. But then it comes again, like, how long will that satisfy me, you know? So it is hard to like, I mean, I know this is like a repeated rhetoric with me, but it is hard to just make an opportunity for yourself, for be the change you want to see when you don't have money and you have responsibilities that you can't escape from because of money.
Yeah. You live in a vacuum. You don't live in a vacuum. Like, you live with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's also like, I have a family and stuff. So it's like, I can't just keep putting my dream first, you know? And then it's like, okay, you keep putting your dream first. And then you're like, wow, I sacrificed so much for this. Was it even worth it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes it won't feel like that. Also, kind of like going back to the earlier conversation of me going like, well, I wanted to make more art. I want my art to like make a bigger impact. I don't want escapism. I feel like the artist you're talking about, she's kind of going through what like Duchamp was feeling, where he was like, no, I'm not going to distract y'all from the tragedies that are happening. My art is going to make you think about what is happening. I'm not going to distract you.
Yeah, exactly. It's not an escapism tool, right? It's something that we'll have meaning and will be deeply critical. Yeah. But, you know, for Charlotte, at the end, that was not quite enough. Art was not quite enough of an impact for her in society. But before we get there, during the 60s, she increasingly starting to minimize her use of colors and shapes, and would usually just indicate landscapes, for example, with horizontal lines to denote the sky and the earth. And as her interest in constructivism grew, she also started painting a series of simple black ink circles, sort of like musical notes. And also during this period, she really began her sculpture work. And it was greatly to the credit of this exhibition, curated by Constantine Adamopoulos and Burkhard Bern, who was actually her husband that administered her estate, and that we can really understand sort of the leap in her art. So like a lot of American minimalists, she was very preoccupied with industrial materials and methods of serial production. And this devotion to industrial fabrication ultimately led to her to the subject of her sociological research, which is what she eventually pivoted into after art. So in her and Brunn's 1979 dissertation, it critiqued how factory workers' labor was assessed through objective qualities, like how many widgets can you make in an hour, right? And they claim that these forms of analysis took agency and input away from the workers themselves. And her husband was explaining that their goal of their research was to identify how exploitation really works, how a worker's lifetime is taken away from him, and how he eventually becomes a mere accessory to the machine. Which I think is true. When you start sort of measuring everybody by metrics and KPIs.
Well, I feel like this is the start of the problem we face right now. How a lot of people feel like they're just a cog in a machine when they go to work.
Yeah. It's because like your performance is measured by tangible things that you can output, you know, versus like answering the question, did you make, you know, a change today, I guess. Yeah. So her later works took even a step further than most in the way that they invited participation. During the last 2 years of her studio practice, from 1967 to 1968, she created 5 groups of sculptures with modular parts. Series A, B and Series C are relief sculptures in monochromatic shades of red, black, blue, or yellow, which could be installed or hinged on in various configurations. Series D consisted of air deck sculptures in galvanized steel, and the Series DW sculptures in cardboard can be assembled in any way the consumer chooses. And her final Series E, called Turning Leaves, consisted of 4-sided human-sized sculptures with wings that can be manipulated by exhibition viewers. So very much like you, the audience, get to make art essentially with the building blocks that I've put out for you. And the scale and interactive nature of these works more closely resembled experimental stage sets, all back to her early career, than sculptures. And during her lifetime, she installed them in a lot of unconventional public locations, like an airplane hangar or a traffic island. But at the end of the day, anonymity was very important to her. And shifting between minimal and conceptual art, she viewed her function as that of a supplier who made material available, but did not have to be present at the moment of artistic realization, like the installation of piece in an exhibition space. And gradually, she became even more indifferent as to whether or not her creations could be identified as art. So I think she's starting to reach this point where her whole goal is like, let me put the building blocks out there for people to create art, right? Like, let me put together some creative constraints on you and see what you can make out of it. And really encourage that sort of audience interaction with her work, which is really interesting. Definitely not something I think we've really seen. So, and in her Klein Gallery exhibition brochure, she introduced the DIY approach to her sculpture with a statement that reads like a user-friendly furniture assembly manual. You can proceed according to a set program, or you can pick individual possibilities according to your personal taste, she explains. After all, there's enough of them. Don't worry if you're never done, because the recombination could proceed in perpetuity without ever becoming boring. Unlike a lot of her middle peers, she refused to philosophize about the work, what else they are or can mean, art and stuff like that will not be discussed here, she wrote. The main thing is that you can change things. At the end, she added, have fun. And I think even though she doesn't want to philosophize about her work, that statement, the main thing is that you can change things, is her saying the philosophy of her work, right? It's like, I'm giving you the tools so you can feel empowered to change and make things, right? It's kind of like what you guys were saying, like, you know, sometimes it feels like I've got outside responsibilities or, you know, like I got other priorities in my life, right? But like, I think within her exhibition, she really puts that feeling to you that you can change things. And at any point in your life, right? Or like you can take action, right? And do anything in your life.
I think when a exhibition is interactive, it's more memorable.
Yeah.
So I feel like for her to be like, okay, you already took time out of your day to come see this, to come see me, to come interact with my art in some way. Let me take it a step further. Let me let you be creative. Let me give you time to be that, to explore that, since you already went out of your way to just come look at creativity.
Exactly. That's a really good point. I agree. Mm-hmm. Tico, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, like, that's the type of stuff you see that you're like, oh, yeah, I should take action. I should do this. But then, and it's like in the heat of the moment, you're like, oh, yeah, this is totally feasible, you know? Yeah. But then, yeah, then you start thinking about it more and you're like,
Yeah, I agree. It's in the heat of the moment, you're like, yeah, you're right. And then afterwards, you're like, I go back to my daily life.
Well, it's kind of like how cults do it. You have to constantly be feeding that that mentality in order to keep the energy going, you know?
So really the answer is Charlotte should have just made a ton of sculptures everywhere so she was in your face all the time.
Maybe. That's a answer. That's a possibility.
I thought you were going to say she should have started a cult.
I was thinking that.
Well, she didn't either. What she actually did was she stopped working as an artist in 1968 at the age of 37.
Ugh, good for her. It's exhausting.
It's exhausting. But I think she went on to do something equally as exhausting. So a year after that, she began a sociology PhD program in the University of Frankfurt with her partner, Burkhard Bern. Her ambitions to improve conditions for factory workers.
Wait, so is she like divorced at this point?
No.
Is this like the same husband?
It's the same husband, yeah.
Okay.
And against the backdrop of the 1968 student revolutions, she penned a fire manifesto for Art International that is considered her farewell address. It traces her development from a socially committed formalist artist to a budding sociologist. She says, there are decreasingly recognizable as artworks. The object should have been the objective character of industrial products, she declared by way of explaining her most recent sculptures made of steel and cardboard. She continued with a damning assessment of the art world. Though art's formal development has progressed at an increasing tempo, its social function has regressed, she wrote, concluding that it is difficult for me to come to terms with the fact that art contribute nothing to solving urgent social problems. She believed art could no longer influence social interaction or draw attention to social inequalities. Considering her commitment to accessibility, Penensky's decision to stop making art can also be interpreted as a response to the art world's obsession with scarcity and high price tags. Some art historians understood her 1968 manifesto in this way. It is frequently framed as a rejection of art, but in their reading, she's disillusioned with the art world as a way of disseminating the works that she's made. And she's continued to work on sociology until her death in 1985, becoming a specialist in employment industrial working processes. She refused to visit any exhibitions during this period or show her work. There have been a few posthumous, posthumous exhibitions of her square tubes, mainly in galleries and public spaces. Only now displayed in the context of her entire artistic output, does her significance to the history of modernity become apparent. The DIA Beacon art curator, which is in upstate New York, Alexa Lowry said that Penensky's work changes our understanding of what minimalism can be. While so much of minimalist art is predicated on the passive experience of an object in a pristine setting, Penensky explodes that idea, Lowry says. Her work requires hands-on active participation of consumers, and in doing so, breaks down the rigid distinctions between art, curator, collector, and viewer. So I think I wanted to talk about her because she took a essentially forever hiatus on art after becoming sort of disillusioned with what she can do with it. But I think at the end of the day, she still, I think, imparts really important messages, even within her art. Like, clearly we're sitting here talking about her art instead of her sociology research, which I'm sure is also impactful. But I think the messages of, like, trying to get audiences and consumers to interact and really sort of breaking the barriers between who is art accessible to and what its purpose is very refreshing, right? Especially when just a few weeks ago we were talking about a rich dude who wanted to build a lot of open air sculptures in his private property and working with artists to achieve his mission, right? Versus Charlotte, who's like, I want this to be for everybody and everybody should get their own opportunity to create art, right? Like, you as the viewer are an artist as well. Message as well. I think it's very impactful and makes me think a lot.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of what she felt and went through isn't abnormal in the art world as an artist. Because there was also a time that I was very disillusioned with, like, art, not because I didn't feel that art wasn't doing anything for the betterment of society, but I just felt that, like, it was inaccessible to have a career in it when you come from a specific background.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, so I feel like part of my issue, though, with artists that want to be making these big changes, I'm just like, who is your audience, really?
Yeah.
Because you are making these exhibitions, these things, at a gallery. Who goes to a gallery? Not the common folk.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're literally preaching to a choir that goes against what you're preaching about. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I feel like she would have been more satisfied if she made, like, installations, like, that would go in public spaces where everyone can interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, like, a gallery where you have to have a job that gives you time in the day, like your weekday or weekend, to have time to go see it. And who has that? Probably not the people she, like, was trying to represent.
Yeah, like doing things kind of like Neil Dawson, right, where he was doing a lot of civic sculptures, like sculptures that were put into civic places, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Government squares and things like that, where people would interact with more so on a daily basis. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, just the medium of how art is displayed inherently discriminates against who is able to go and view the art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, also, when you were saying that, I really was thinking about Banksy and how he did the whole, like, image shredding at a Sotheby's event, right? Like, I'm sure he had a big big message about art can't be confined and can't be bought like this, and, like, I'm gonna shred it. But at the end of the day, the elite who were there and saw that happen were just like, oh my god, another Banksy exclusive.
I think it's funny how 2 years later you literally see the whole point why I made that episode.
Yeah. It's all coming together.
It only took 2 years.
Yes. I'm like, her redemption arc?
Yeah, I get it. I get it. No, I always get it. I just want to play the devil's advocate.
Whatever, Manchi. Whatever.
Yes.
So you literally waited 2 years later to be like, I was just fucking with y'all. I literally, you don't know how much stress that caused in my life. I literally went to class and I was like, guys, am I wrong?
I'm sorry.
He later became my boss, but I talked to the gallery guy, he wasn't even an assistant because he was like he wasn't like the main gallery guy, like he wasn't like the boss of the gallery, but he did, like, set up all the exhibits and stuff at the university's gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what do you think of Banksy? And he's all like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. And then I explained to him. He's all like, well. And then I was all like, okay, all right. Then I was like, but is my opinion right? And he's like, well, you are correct. And as to why you, like, got that conclusion of of him, and then you are right in your criticisms. I'm like, okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was causing so much angst.
Because I was all like, am I being like not necessarily like mean to you, but I was like, am I being too critical of this man I don't even know? Like, and then I was like, why am I letting this fucking affect me? Why is some man's action just letting them like affect my mood, my day, my interpersonal life?
That's a true artist's impact.
Not with that man.
Not with Banksy.
Not with Banksy.
I mean, I guess the question is any emotion good emotion?
Okay, Miss Nihilist. I'm not gonna join this discourse. So not today, Miss Devil's Advocate.
Not today, Agent.
Not today. Agent of Chaos.
Before. Oh yeah, I think that's what you called her last time, Agent of Chaos, maybe.
I don't think so. Dude, I say so much shit on this podcast. You're like, do you remember? I'm like, no, I don't remember. I just open my mouth. I say what comes to mind, and then I forget. I let it all out.
It's like goes in one ear out the other, but it's like in your head, out your mouth, and gone forever. But
I will say, I don't really like it in life. I don't always say what's on my mind, right? But when it comes to like conversations like this, I'm like, here's my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, that's what this is, an open forum, right?
Yes, but here's the thing. I'm guessing, I'm realizing not every conversation is open forum. So I should maybe have more finesse. Yeah. Or I guess I'm realizing I don't have that as much finesse as I thought I did.
I'm also realizing that too.
Really, Manchi.
Yeah.
This has been our argument since we've known each other.
It's been like 10 years, hasn't it?
Yes. Like, this is why I did not like this woman for a long time.
All the truths are coming out.
I've been telling you the truths. Here's the thing about me. You will always know where you stand with me.
That's true. That is very true.
You're never like, does she hate me? Does she not? I'll be like, here's the deal. Here's my observations. And then people get mad at me because sometimes they're a little too on the nose.
You know, I feel like you were, yeah, no, you're right. You wouldn't be talking to us if you didn't like us.
But here's the thing. I feel like you're in the minority, but I appreciate this, that you like take it with grace. You're like, let me contemplate on that. Versus other people, they're like, what? Let me justify my actions. You don't know me. And it's like, okay, well, your actions have consequences.
Yeah.
Also, like, people love to tell other people their flaws, but they can't take it when it's like dished back to them.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not gonna sit here and let you like tell me I have X, Y, and Z flaw. I'm like, I'm gonna tell you yours too.
I think the reason. Yeah, I mean, I think it's always good to have reflection, like, people to let you know, because it's like, you need to.
I feel like it's how you know if somebody's like really egotistical, if not. Okay. If they are genuinely egotistical, they will take great offense.
Yeah.
But if they're not that egotistical, they're open to like, let me reflect on my actions.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I just want to be a better human being, you know, so.
As you play devil's advocate.
Listen, at the end of the day, we still need to make drama in a drama podcast.
Okay, well, I would assume the drama comes from the content we're retelling, not so much from us. But you know, life imitates art and art imitates life.
There you go.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
That should be our logo.
Okay.
Our drama imitates life drama. Life drama imitates art drama. Yeah.
Drama imitates art.
Yeah.
And art imitates drama.
There you go. Even more succinct.
On that note, if you have any stories you would like us to cover, please email us at ourtraumalama@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon, where our handles all. Oh,
shit, it's not recording. What?
It's still recording.
It is, Mitchie.
Wait. Oh. Okay, sorry. I the screen smaller, and then I stopped seeing the pause and stop recording option. I was like, wait, what? And then I was looking at the top right corner for the recording button, and it's not on the top right corner, so then I freaked out. Okay. I'm so sorry, Tika. I'm sorry. Had a minor heart attack there.
I mean, she's losing not that. It. She's yeah. losing it. You know, I think that is what I called her a few episodes ago, like dementia. See? You just keep proving me right.
Oh, God. That was bad. I'm so sorry. I did not. I just...
Please keep that in.
All right. Well, on that note, if you have any stories you would like us to cover, email us at ourdramalama@gmail.com. You should also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon, where our handles are all at ourdramalama. And lastly, thank you for joining us, and we hope we can continue looking beyond the galleries with y'all next time. Bye, llamas.
Bye.